Hello, this is Mark Shanton. Welcome you to the second part of Theatre Voice's regular critical roundups. We've already discussed a series of revivals, and now the same team of Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph, Matt Wolfe of the International Tribune, and David Bennett of Variety are joining me again to talk about three new works. We have two new plays, Jez Butterworth's Jerusalem, being staged at the Royal Court in a production by Ian Rickson that stars Mark Rylance as Johnny Byron, a sometime drug dealer and free spirit about to be evicted from his illegal encampment, and the transfer of Katori Hall's The Mountaintop from the Fringe Theatre 503 in Battersea to the West End's Trafalgar Studios, with David Harewood playing Martin Luther King on the last night of his life. We also have a new musical, Sister Act, based on the 1992 film comedy of the same name, which has Bettina Miller in the Whoopi Goldberg role of a lounge singer who, on the run from her mobster boyfriend, seeks refuge as a nun in a convent. Let's start with Jerusalem, Matt. Jez Butterworth and Ian Rickson have a long-established relationship, going back all the way to Mojo, which was Jez Butterworth's debut play at the Royal Court. Does it pay off in this play?
Oh, in spades, I think. This is their fifth collaboration, and I think it's their best. I mean, what was thrilling about this play for me is that when a playwright is acclaimed, and yet after a while you feel as if he's discovering a different voice within himself, as I think Jez Butterworth is here, it's an absolute revelation. I've admired Jez Butterworth in the past very much, but I've always felt as if it was a bit of Pinter, you know, fed through Tarantino. It was very blokish. It was very male. I think this play is a masterpiece. I will say that. And I think it's served up in the production of One's Dreams with an absolutely titanic performance from Mark Rylance that nonetheless allows the rest of the cast to be an ensemble. It's not the Mark Rylance show, but he means there's a heart-stopping performance from Mackenzie Crook as the best friend of this sort of reprobate. It's a play that strikes incalculably many echoes. It's sort of like Hair without the Galt McDermott music. It has echoes of Arcadia, Translations, Shakespeare, the Bible. I think it's an astonishment.
Yeah, it's a big, brawny, bulky play, isn't it? 3 hours, 20 minutes in two intervals. But I think you loved it too, Charlie.
Yeah, it's terrific, I think. I think it really is, and it sort of lingers a lot in the memory. It's completely of itself, despite all these influences. And I think, you know, you get the Midsummer Night's Dream must have been in his mind, I think, as he wrote it. It's a fantastically English play. It's about an England we don't see much, which is sort of rural ne'er-do-wells rather than city desperate kids and things. Fantastically funny, but also touching and mysterious. I mean, it's incredible how many moods it range over. And right the way through, you never know whether the Rylance character, Johnny Byron, is essentially a lovable but essentially harmless eccentric, or, you know, there may be something much darker going on. I think it's terrific. And Rylance, if he doesn't get the Best Actor awards, it will only because Sam West and Enron gets them. It's going to be a titanic battle, I think, between both plays and shows for the best of the year. To have seen these two plays within 10 days of each other is extraordinary testament to the strength.
And it's very, 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 very different to the last Rickson and Butterworth collaboration.
Absolutely.
Song at the Almeida.
I mean, I basically agree with my colleagues here, but particularly Matt, in the sense that I've always admired but not particularly liked Butterworth's work in the past. Even Mojo, I thought, okay, great dialogue. Where's the play? And the rest have been sub-pinted. Parlour Song was basically the plot of The Lover meets Old Times with Ruth from The Homecoming thrown in. I mean, it was so derivative. It was absolutely astonishing. Rickson gave it a production of Butterworth's Dreams over here. It was turned down by the Royal Court because clearly there wasn't enough substance to it, but they did pick up Jerusalem because, boy, could they see that that was a really good play. And it absolutely is, and I'm just going to echo what everybody else is saying, that it has so many moods, it has so many colours, and yes, it's slightly too long, it's a bit baggy, it's a bit indulgent, and you don't care. Oh, because that is part of its idiosyncrasy, in that its world is so incredibly creative. You go, well, I don't mind. And it's interesting because I, for quite a bit of the first half and a bit of the second, I thought, I'm not sure I like this play. I admire it, but I'm not sure I like it. And by the end, I went, no, I really do. It's sort of playing on things that I find quite disturbing, and that's why it's so extraordinary. And that balance in which you're kept over is Rylance's character loathsome or lovable? Well, the answer is he's both, and it's the contradictions that make people interesting, and it's something that dramatists very rarely dare to do. Too many writers make their minds up about their characters, and you know perfectly well what the dramatist thinks about them, so it becomes dull to watch. Here, you're constantly kept... The moments are kept alive because decisions are not being made for you. It pays the audience the compliment of holding you and making you make your mind up.
I think the other thing that really needs to be said, because we make it sound a bit solemn, is it is absolutely fantastically funny. Mm. A lot of the scenes, particularly with Mackenzie Crook, he's such a sort of nervy hanger-on. I mean, it's slightly a recreation of his role in The Office, and you know, the money's not quite in the scene and desperately wants to be, but he is very funny. And I think the double act between him and Ryan, just the sight of Rylance having that breakfast, when he's absolutely the most extraordinary breakfast you can imagine, though I have had something similar.
It's a pint of milk, you watch him do it. He pours a pint of milk, he cracks a raw egg into it, then vodka and speed. Now, I suspect that the latter two are props rather than real, but nonetheless,
you never know with this cast.
He stands there and drinks a pint of milk with an egg in it every night and twice on matinee days.
I mean, there's a hyper-realism type of thing. I mean, in fact, not just the set by Oates, which is full of these fantastic trees.
There are real hens pecking underneath the caravan.
Yeah,
the
I
woods.
Loved that when I saw that.
But also the smells. I mean, you actually smell the paraffin at one point.
The play also does something that I think we hope theatre does a lot. Charlie alluded to it a bit, but theatre actually doesn't do very much, I don't find, which is that it recharges a sense of mystery. It's got a genuine mystery to it. It's a play about storytelling. It's a play in which giants move in its midst. All of that, the ending is like a white English version of August Wilson, except instead of August Wilson in a play like Joe Turner's Come and Gone, where the whole history of black ancestral lore is folded into Harold Loomis, here it's the entire weight of what's come before folded into Johnny Byron. It's a remarkable achievement.
There are two things I want to add. One is to echo Charlie, and that I think Mark Rylance is doing something utterly extraordinary. He does a handstand into a water trough, like the most extraordinary ballet dancer. I mean, I've always thought that Mark Rylance was this kind of thin person, like the nerd he played in Boeing.
Oh, he's bulked
up. This big, brawny guy who suddenly does this balletic handstand in order to stick his head in a water trough to wake himself up one morning. And he's thundering about the stage, but he also has this weird stillness. There is a scene with his wife, brilliantly played by Lucy Montgomery. The scene is absolutely pivotal to your duality of feeling. And she looks at him and he says, "Look in my eyes." Mm. And she sees something in his eyes that's really scary. And you can feel the whole audience going, "Shit, there is something going on in that man's head."
She sees what's going to happen to him, doesn't she?
Yeah, but it's a remarkable moment. And what Butterworth's doing here is writing for actors. And I know that's a really fatuous thing to say, because that's what all dramatists do, except they don't. That not a lot of writers really write for what an actor can do. This is also a State of the Nation play, but undreamt of by the likes of David Hare, because no one makes speeches about what the nation's doing or what Englishness really is. And, you know, it's not Racing Demon, which is actually a very good play, but it's
his best play.
It's his best play, but this is a State of the Nation play by writing it as a comedy, as a passion piece, all sorts of things, without actually having terrible debates.
And he's a pig farmer in Wiltshire now, and so it's all absolutely... all that stuff about him being barred from every pub in the village, you know, and he's
trying... I don't think it's Butterworth,
but that is the kind of talk that you get in, because we live down in Dorset quite a lot of the time, and it gets that country life, which is so unrepresented on our stages, so well. I think it's a real breakthrough play.
As you say, Charlie, it is very, very English in absolutely the best sense, and yet I think it's actually fantastically universal. I think it would do very well in America, particularly with Rylance.
American audiences on Broadway gasp when someone says "fuck." This says "cunt" about once every 2 minutes. Yeah.
But it takes you on a wild ride.
It does. It really does.
On an alternate on an altogether different scale, The Mountaintop is just a two-hander. And I think, David, you and I are the only ones who've actually seen this. I've actually seen it twice. I saw it first at Theatre 503.
Well, I should interview you and say, how different is it, Mark, on a big space?
Well, I was worried that it wouldn't expand to fill the space, and I think it does, actually, in a very intriguing way.
I mean, I think for the first 20 minutes I went, oh, God, I hate these sort of plays. Two people in a room in which the innocent character asks the famous character all about their life, and then they're either celebrated or debunked, depending on the attitude of the playwright. Oh, how much longer is this? And then something happens, which we can't actually reveal. There is a big moment where the rug gets pulled out of what you think is one of those bog-standard biodramas, and everything changes, and the power balance seesaws, and it turns into something, without giving it away, it turns into something much more surreal and much more interesting. I don't think this is a play without flaw, but I think it's a really, really interesting piece from this sounds patronising, but it is a really interesting piece from a young writer, and it becomes really absorbing because you suddenly realise that all bets are off, and you go, oh, I didn't think it was going to be like this. Oh, well, now I don't know what's going to happen. Tell me. And she uses, the writer, Katori Hall, uses her perspective as a young black woman writing about the past and the civil rights movement in a really, really interesting way.
I think it's still going to be a very tough sell in the West End, and I know they want to take it to Mute to America, where
off-Broadway,
where it would be much more resonant because of the...
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, our response to... We're all sitting around the table, we're all white, but our response to the to Martin Luther King on stage is going to be very different from America, where the demographic is entirely different. And but nonetheless, I do think that it is rather fascinating about where America has been and where America has come, and attitudes to that. And to an extent, it is also a more universal play. It isn't solely for those interested in Martin Luther King. You know, it is about how people see themselves at a particular moment. This is, it all happens on the night before his assassination. It's set in one room in the Lorraine Motel where he stayed,
and of which he has premonitions.
Absolutely, and you know, I'm not sure I ever sort of really clocked what that. Okay, this is Martin Luther King. An enormous American hero. He's in the grungiest, dingiest of motel rooms, beautifully realised by the designer Libby Watson. And you suddenly go, okay, no, he wasn't this towering figure then. He was a compelling preacher who had an incredible movement behind him that, of course, encouraged racists to shoot him, and he was having premonitions of his death, probably in reality. And that's what happens to him here. And it is fascinating to see a piece of history dramatised in that way that is so unexpected.
I was reminded that we once saw a truly terrible West End musical about Martin Luther King called King.
Yes.
And how much more successful this is.
A friend of mine used to work at the Piccadilly in those days and used to answer the telephone, "Hello, Piccadilly, House of Hits."
And from one musical to another, sister act, finally, film stage adaptation of a 1992 film comedy, which I absolutely loathed, but I think not everybody around this table did.
I'm slightly surprised that you could loathe it. I can think of plenty of musicals that I have loathed, but this seems to me to have an awful lot wrong with it, but it actually has that quite rare quality of good heart. And most of the problems of the show are in the first half of the first act. Some of the exposition is unbelievably clunky, and the production does it no favours whatsoever. It has some indifferent choreography. It has a brilliant lighting design by Natasha Katz, because she basically, apart from some chases across the cathedral-like set, lighting chases, she keeps the light off the set because the set is flat and ugly and serviceable. But, as I say, it's got heart, and it's got a fantastic central performance from Patina Miller.
The script, I thought, was flat and humourless and didn't rise come to the boil at all.
I just feel with all these musicals now that are based on movies that they're okay, but they could be so much better. Where's the real imagination? I'm afraid Jack O'Brien set the bar very, very high for me with Hairspray, which remains for me my favorite of all of these. I preferred this to Priscilla because I think it's less calculated and cynical, but it still should be a lot better than it is. And I would like to declare a moratorium following this and Billy Elliot of musicals with songs for crusty old dears who were meant to find instantly adorable because they swear and can raise their legs. That is so cheesy and patronizing. It's it I think this is another show that will improve exponentially if and when it gets to America.
If and when they get a decent director in. I mean, Peter Schneider was sacked from the show.
Not officially. He's still billed.
He is still billed. But
a new woman was brought in.
Yeah, the associate director was brought in, and I think Anthony Van Last's role was beefed up on the production. But I just keep saying the same thing. It sort of got me in the end, even though I was just, it sort of, I kept having suspicions. And I agree with you that, you know, do we have to see the problem that you analyse there, Matt, is you know, when you do a movie of a loved, when you do a musical of a loved movie, how dramatically different do you become? The triumph of Billy Elliot is it's a fuck of a sight better than the movie, which is sentimental and weak. The greatness about Daldry and Peter Darling's work on Billy Elliot is that it's wildly theatrically imaginative. This isn't, but it got away with it.
Yeah, and it has, as you say, it's got this terrific star performance. I'd also say that the music is really good. It really gets the 70s music, yeah. Disco style, really well.
There's some terrific pastiche.
Yeah, I mean, it is just pastiche.
It's a great,
what
Barry
it does,
White number.
What it does extremely well. And I can't remember if I went to the first night. I think I went to a preview. I can't remember. I think it was a preview for some. No, I think they listened to a preview or something. I can't remember. But it's very much a Palladium show and a Palladium audience, and they are having the time of their lives at it. And it does. I'm not saying it's a great piece of art, but as David says, it's got heart. It's got a sensational lead performance, and it's great fun. And I don't think that, you know, we need that sometimes.
It is interesting with a lot of these stage adaptations, though, of films. Rain Man comes to mind. These are movies which traverse a lot of ground, and when you adapt that sort of thing for the stage, it's very, very hard. And actually, the narrative in the film of Sister Act, which was no masterpiece, but it was hugely, hugely popular, was more interesting in terms of where it went, and it took Dolores on a journey. This doesn't really take her anywhere, particularly. So I don't know why they keep adapting for the stage films that are road movies.
Well, it's like a commission, isn't it?
It's not quite a road.
It's got that aspect, though.
No, I mean, but basically, once they've gone, once they're in the nunnery, they're in the one place, aren't they? Which is most of the film, or sort of two thirds of the film. I agree. The whole San Marino bit didn't come over really. That was just the setup. But I do think those singing nuns were great fun, I must say.
And I really resented the fact that Sheila Hancock was, who I love, was completely wasted in the role of the Mother Superior.
Not as badly wasted as Ian Lavender was.
Ian Lavender, gosh.
I think a veil should be drawn. but no, I mean, the script is so functional it's embarrassing. I mean, I do think this is one of those in spite of everything shows. You know, yes, we could take apart the script. Yes, we could take apart Ian Lavender's performance. Yes, there's the choreography is not much more than hand jiving.
It's pretty hard with all these habits.
Absolutely, but you know, you just imagine what Rob Ashford would do with that. You know, it's just, come on, do something more interesting. But I have to say, I just, in the end, I found it irresistible, and I went, you know, I'm having a good time. The audience around me. There are some incredibly witty touches. There's a great moment where the love interest, who's this sort of nerdy policeman who's a bit hopeless. His clothes are stripped off him, and underneath he's dressed as Barry White, and you go, that's quite funny. And then at the end of the number, when he reverts to being a nerd, they're stripped off him again and he's back to being the nerd, and you go, that's really clever to do that twice. And Menken's music is generic, but really, really smart generic. It's very, very good 70s.
The cast album, which is now out, will be very popular, I think.
On that note, thank you, Matt, David and Charlie.